Welcome. It's time for another conversation about the landmarks. We are now on the third landmark labeled Wounds, all based on the book Landmarks, Turning Points on Your Journey Toward God. We will again have three men taking part in this conversation about our lives. My name's Bill Delvo, and I'll be the moderator. Daniel Moore, who has been a part of the first two conversations, will be joining us again. And the third man will be another good friend of mine and former boss, Richard Anderson. Men, thanks for coming into the studio today to share your lives. It's great to have you, both of you here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So far, we've progressed through the first two landmarks, Story, which was landmark number one, and Idols, landmark number two. Story dealt with how we all disconnect from God and the story he is writing and try to author our own stories, which is really what sin is. Idols continue that line of thought because our idols are all the baggage and props we drag into our stories to make them work without reference to God. They become our deep core sins. Now, when we come to the third landmark, we turn the tables. For in our present existence, there is another force at work. It's not our core sins. It's how we've been sinned against. For we're all connected to others who are also caught up in scripting their own narratives. They're fallen creatures like us. And when their scripts crash into ours, we find ourselves hurt, betrayed, deceived, shamed, and even crushed. We're all the walking wounded. To own and live out of the new selves that Jesus wants to give us, we must deal with our sins. It's certainly true. But we must also face and deal with the wounds, how we've been sinned against. Both are needed to recover our true hearts and to begin to have an intimate connection with the Lord and with others. So facing, walking back through this, our wounds is all, what this landmark is all about. And that's kind of where I want to start our conversation today, men. And let's start it this way. Probably just kind of just go right for the bullseye. And let's just talk about a pivotal story of wounding in our lives. So who wants to start that one? Kind of how it affected you?
Well, I'll start. You know, I would say just kind of generally the wound that I'm aware of started when I was pretty young and growing up in a home where two parents who were Christians. I was the oldest of three children, but I remember there was a lot of tension in my home between my two parents, a lot of arguing and just discord. And as a young boy growing up in that, observing that, you know, listening in at times when they'd have heated arguments, kind of what I observed between them, I wasn't sure how to make sense of their relationship and therefore kind of my life. You know, my parents represented to me, they're the most powerful people in my life. And if they so struggled with each other, what did that mean just about life in general? And one memory that's representative of a lot of memories was being on a family vacation with my all five of us and my sisters and I watching television because my parents, you know, got into some argument and seemed like the whole day just behind closed doors arguing, you know. We'd hear yelling through the door, and that kind of thing seemed, as I remember now, seemed to happen quite a bit.
It seems so unsafe. I mean, probably felt just, you know, that kind of lack of safety and security in a home.
It really did. It really did. And then, you know, some of the tension of having two younger sisters whom I, at some level, because I was older, you know, felt this need or desire to protect them or care for them in it. And so, you know, having to kind of put my own fears aside and nurture them and just, kind of the unsafety of life that came out of observing and witnessing this over the years. And then later on in life, I was, you know, late teens when some infidelity came to light. And then that was a whole nother, and in some ways it's just more of the same, but it kind of added another level of fear and betrayal and how do you make sense of life with this new knowledge. But it was still more of the same of just trying to make sense of this world that my family represented that that felt very unsafe to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel personally in danger by their relationship, but I felt like life, home was not a safe
place. Yeah, if home's not safe, where is?
Exactly.
Where are you going to find it?
Yeah.
You know, where am I going to find that place of nurture and comfort? Yeah, if it's not there. Well, my story, I don't really have a pivotal story of wounding, and it took me so long to put words to this because mine is so much about the wounding of absence. I didn't have somebody speak something terrible to me or somebody abuse me in some way. It was just a huge void, and it came up in things that happened to me growing up and in school and outside of school, but there was this vague sense of just being unattached. And from about age 8 on, I just sort of kind of intuited that I had to figure out life on my own. And no boy can do that. Particularly as you enter manhood, it's just, it feels like you said, for me, so unsafe. Life felt so insecure. And I began to just avoid many things that felt like failure, potential shame. I couldn't risk. And because of that, I felt very much disconnected from my peers, because I felt disconnected particularly from my father. My father was a very busy man, doctor, and didn't know really how to enter my life or my brothers and sisters' lives then. So we were sort of, I felt like I was left to fend for myself. One particular story that I pulled up, I haven't thought about in a long time, that illustrates this, how this worked in me. I was in the 10th grade, and I was walking up the steps into the study hall, and it was after school, and I don't remember why I was there, but I looked out onto the soccer field, and this was many years ago, and they just started soccer here in the area, and it was a winter sport. And so there were all my friends who were out there playing, and I remember I stopped and I looked out onto the soccer field, and just this cold sort of stabbing pain went inside of me that I've felt many times before. And underneath that was this sort of agreement, this sort of promise that I'd made to myself that I could never fail in front of people, and that because of that, I could never risk going out and playing soccer. And I saw how much fun they were having, and I remember thinking, I'll never be a part of that. I will never be a part of that.
It was a longing.
It was that longing that erupted, and immediately I just sort of killed it. Hmm. That's the only way I knew how to manage. So for me, a lot of my wounding ended up being self-wounding, just because there was nobody above me to sort of interpret what was going on. The odd thing is, I look back on my life now, the idea of going to somebody like my father or a teacher or a coach or a relative or anybody to talking about these things never once occurred to me. Mm-hmm. It's not like I thought, oh, I really need to talk to my dad about this. It never even occurred to me that you could go there. So my wounding came from that, and it just really affected me so deeply for many years. Richard, what about you? Well, where do you want to go?
My wounding probably is summarized in a particular event. And it's a bit sort of a two-pronged thought for me. I was in the sixth grade. I was 11 years old. I would turn 12 that summer, and I was in an elementary school of grades 1 through 6. So you're a sixth grader. You're kind of, you know, you're supposed to be on top. You know, you're the king of the king of the mountain, so to speak. This was in the spring of 1962. President Kennedy had instituted a physical fitness regimen for all the youth of America. And so we were going through these physical fitness tests. My PE teacher was also one of my two sixth grade teachers, and he was a very tan, fit, buff young man. At any rate, so we had to do these different things. They were normally timed. You had to do you had to do so many setups in X amount of time. You had to see how far you could throw the ball, whatever. This particular day, we were to do pull-ups. And so I jumped up to the bar and literally could not do one pull-up. Mm. And so that in itself was pretty crushing. But then the coach says in front of the entire sixth grade class, "You are so weak. I have girls in this class that are stronger than you." So I was thinking about this actually on the way over. I don't even know what I did with that evening. I'm sure I didn't tell either one of my parents, certainly not my dad.
Richard, I've heard you tell that story before to me, and even now as I hear you tell it, I just sort of feel this terrible, like surely the story's not going to go this way. That's just an awful thing to have uttered.
I think it has showed me in my vocation as an educator, the power of words and the power that we as educators have to either affirm or to crush a young person.
Right. And I felt that too as a teacher and a coach. I often told people there's wet cement everywhere. You know, you're going to leave a mark, so hopefully it's going to be a good one. So that certainly was a crushing mark that was left in you.
So question, why couldn't you, you said you certainly couldn't tell your dad.
I did not have a good relationship with my dad. I never felt like that I measured up in his eyes.
Yeah.
So for me at that point, you have to understand, I'm only years later as an adult getting in touch with some of this stuff. But what I realized just recently is that I kind of got both barrels. I had two male figures, my dad, who's the most important male figure, and this coach who at age 11 was a very loud male voice in my life. And they're both, at least in my mind, they're both saying, "You don't measure up."
Right. And one by saying verbally and one by not saying anything.
Exactly.
Wow.
Which is back to your thing of absence.
Yeah. Wow. Let's talk a bit about what we did with our wounds. And you've already kind of gone there, Richard. So you may want to pick this up and go on. So usually what we do as men, we sort of lick and cover our wounds and we start running. You know, anything not to sort of face it. And so let's talk about how we sort of dismiss the wound and then sort of the process of the struggle to own it and grieve it. Why don't you go ahead and start us down that track?
Sure. While at one level I denied the wound, I denied how much it hurt. At another level, I put the wound to work for me.
Hmm.
What I mean by that is, and I'm years later looking back on this, I realize now that I subconsciously made a vow on that playground. And the vow was, nobody will ever make me feel like this again.
Yeah.
I will never feel this shame, this kind of shame again. Nobody will ever do that to me again. So my strategy then, I became a chameleon. So I just need you to like me. So whatever, you know, right, whatever you're into, if you're a Christian, I'll go to Bible study with you.
Right.
If you're into drugs and alcohol, I'll do that with you.
Right.
Whatever you need me to do or to be, I became that because I had such a desperate need for you to accept me.
Right.
So I think while I was denying the impact of the wound, I really made a very, very strong vow on that playground at age 11.
Yeah, that's kind of how you walk through it. Wow. Hmm. You know, mine was the way I sort of dealt with this sense of absence and disconnection from people and repeated failures at sports and girls. And I just ran. I just started running. And the same thing, you know, when you said that, I will never feel this way again. That's kind of when I had these experiences, like with the soccer, looking at that soccer team out there on the field, it was like, I can't feel this anymore. I got to start running. And a lot of it was not only running away, literally, like, honestly, I went to college where I went to at Duke because it was the furthest away from Nashville. I wanted to get as far. I felt felt if I could run away from this, I never said that, maybe it would go away. And I look back on that now and see how foolish that strategy was. But, you know, when you're living on your own, you acted on it. Yeah, I did act on it. And what that resulted in, not owning these sorts of deep places where I'd been crushed and not spoken into, what that really left me with, how it manifested itself, was depression. I started struggling with chronic depression in college. I didn't even know what it was. Just these terrible sense of blackness would come over. And, you know, when I left college, I ran away from college. And it's like, well, maybe I can get away. It was just, I was always looking for something else, running to something else. And with a failed church plant in my mid-30s, all that came to a screeching halt. I sort of had to turn and own the wound and begin to grieve it. And that was really, really difficult. My first attempt at it, it sort of just came upon me. I had been teaching at the school for about a couple of years, and they'd started the football team there, and sort of, again, sports represented that place of disconnection for me. And I remember talking to some of the guys on the new football team and feeling something really begin to sort of, a lot of turmoil inside of me. I didn't know what was happening. I walked out into kind of a backfield, and I found myself sobbing uncontrollably. I was starting to grieve.
You were a teenager.
Yeah. I was, and what happened when I started running, I was stuck right there. And to go back and allow that to come up was just, it was so sad and so painful. But I realized when I'm sad, and then when I got angry about it also, I wasn't depressed anymore. And that was like, okay, I'm moving. I'm going someplace. That was a huge insight for me. Daniel, what about you?
Well, I think the best way to describe how I dealt with mine was feeling like I needed to grow up real quickly, and I need to be thoughtful and mature and toe the line in every way I can to get God to like me, to protect myself from kind of the chaos of life.
So being moralistic was a way to be
being
safe.
Moralistic and also being really thoughtful and, quote, mature, at right. least in my own eyes. And and it worked in some ways, kind of like Richard was saying, that he put it to use. I put that to use in a lot of ways. But, you know, I was kind of the hero big brother. I was kind of the hero son. I was kind of the, in a family that wasn't stable, I looked very stable. And
they all look to you probably as the still point,
the anchor.
And the anchor of the storm.
They really did. Yeah. And I remember even at one point my father, when I was in maybe middle school, telling me I was, you know, years more mature than he was when he was in college. And I, at the time, I heard that as both a compliment, but something that felt really, I didn't like him telling me that. And I think even then I kind of intuited, this thing I'm doing looks good and is serving me, but something is off in it. And even being affirmed in it feels not quite settling or good. And so I would say that worked for a while, up until kind of when I discovered, as I mentioned later in my teens, about my father's some infidelity there. And it was kind of like that explosion was so big that I was pretty disoriented in it. And so there's a lot of shifts that happened there. And then, you know, one story that came to mind today, that years later when I was in graduate school, we watched a movie about a boy. It's actually called This Boy's Life. Leonardo DiCaprio is in it. And his situation and mine were very, very different. But the opening scene is him and his mother kind of traveling the country, and she's pretty unstable and way more unstable than my parents were. But the theme of him as a boy trying to make sense of his parents' realities and their difficulties and all the ways he tries to maneuver that, it was very unsettling. I watched the first part of this movie and left the classroom and bawled for an hour.
It touched that core wound.
Touched some core nerve in me. Yeah, it really did. So.
And that was kind of part of your learning degree, sort of learning to face it.
Yeah, it really was. Just some, I couldn't manage anymore the pain.
Right.
God was kind enough to let me feel the pain of it. And, you know, as I'm thinking too, Bill, as we're all talking about kind of the way we maneuver to deny our wounds, I think, why is it so hard to go there when we're younger? And I get, to me, the word just shame comes to mind.
Yes.
There's so much shame about something that we didn't even do.
That's just,
you can't even, the words are,
I know, yeah.
Right, you don't even have a language.
Right.
Exactly.
But part of it is just that the embarrassment that I felt having to face, you know, a difficult family, or that, you know, you would have felt in terms of what the coach said and what would have come out of a conversation with your father. You know, it's almost like you didn't even know where else to go.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's the shaming part of it is the part that's just so annihilating to us. And that's what we have to kind of, you know, get out, you know, push down, run, all of that. So let's finish by talking a little bit about sort of motioning out of it. And I think I want to say this before I go there. I meant to say this. I think all of us look at grief as a terrible thing. It's just bad. You don't want to grieve. My experience of grief is that it is a profoundly healing thing. And certainly there are parts about grief that are uncomfortable. And there are also parts about grief that sometimes feel like I'm going off a cliff. So granted all that, learning to just go there has felt so much better ultimately than running. It's just like, you know, you feel alive again.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think when we grieve is where we meet the Lord too.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the other process of this, which is so tricky and difficult, which is forgiveness. These wounds are often inflicted by absence or by people's presence on us. And, you know, the Lord said, you know, as you've received forgiveness from me, you need to offer that forgiveness. So somehow all of this is related in terms of owning our own forgiveness as sons before the Father. So let's talk about the process of forgiveness. What's it been like for you and your struggles with it?
I'll start.
Yeah.
So as I'm thinking about all of this, I think that for me, when life is hard, you look to someone to blame. And so when I was young, I looked to my parents. But even beyond my parents, there's a sense in which, God, how that this happened to me,
right,
you know?
Right.
And actually in your book, you mention, is it the author Jeremiah and Lamentations and all the devastation?
Right,
and,
right.
You know, the lament psalms where they begin with grief and end in worship. And I think for me, a lot of grieving has, what I have found when I don't grieve, it's on me, the pressure's on my shoulders to find a way to survive. When I grieve, it's like I drop all of that. And in some ways, I kind of point my finger in God's face and come to a place of finding a stable rock of His love that's been there the whole time, that I realize has survived all my pain, and that the buck doesn't stop with me. And so only in grieving, my grief has included anger. And when I'm really honest, anger at God.
Yes.
And when I find in that He handles that, forgives me of it, invites it, as you mentioned in your book, wrestling with God. And then it's so interesting because when I go there, it's only afterwards that I discover something in me that has survived the pain, the shame, and the anger, which is it's like God meets me in it.
I know that experience.
And then the power of the wound and the people who've wounded me just doesn't seem as big. So it's like only when I'm able to do that have I been able to extend grace to, for instance, my parents, and realize, as you've mentioned again in your book, referencing that they're wounded folks who have wounded folks, you know, and my parents and all of the stuff that they wrestled with comes out of their own stories and their pain. And so for me, grieving has been humongous
Yes.
in terms of the act of coming to a place of forgiveness.
Right.
And I would
and
say
you really can't forgive until you grieve.
No.
You can't do it.
And it's a process. I mean, I would say I'm still in the process of that.
It's definitely a process.
But not holding my wound against my parents.
Right.
But kind of letting God be God in my life and also letting God be God in their lives. Mm. And I don't need to be God in either.
Yeah.
Right. I don't have to hold their sin over them.
Yeah, I don't have to hold it all together. Yeah. That's good. That's good. I had a lot of anger towards my father for a number of years just because of the absence. And for me, one of the places where I was really able to forgive him, forgiveness has been a process. I had a conversation with him one time and said, Dad, what did you do with your father? Because he never told me. I never heard any stories about, and I never knew my grandfather. He died before I was born. And we were out at Starbucks having coffee, and he looked down, and he looked up with this expression that I don't know if I've ever quite seen in his face before. And all he said was, well, that about says it all, doesn't it? And it was all of a sudden like the neon lights just went off in me. It's like he
couldn't come up with anything.
He didn't have a connection with his father. He was just handing that on to me. He didn't have the capability. Hmm. It just wasn't in him to do so. He didn't have any modeling for that. And all of a sudden I saw my father not as an enemy or as somebody who's trying to get me, but just somebody who's just trying to manage and get through life the best they could. And I could just feel this compassion for my father. It just kind of welled up inside of me. It was really a remarkable experience. So there are many other stories in terms of forgiveness, but that's certainly a pivotal one for me. Kind of like what you said, you begin to see your parents not as the chief enemies, Daniel, but is also having their own woundedness.
My forgiveness is, again, sort of two-prong. In about 1985, I was at a prayer retreat, and this young Episcopal priest, this was down in Florida, he said, when you go back home, he said, I want you to go back to the playground. And so I literally did. It's not too far from where I live today. I went back to the playground, and he said, I want you to picture Jesus standing there by that chin-up bar. And
was the chin-up bar still there?
Yeah, it's still there. So basically, without belaboring the point, I was able to speak forgiveness to that coach, but also was able to hear Jesus say, I've already done the pull-ups. This doesn't define who you are. That's 1985. Mm. The other surprise came earlier this year in 2013, working with a counselor on some things, and she put me through an exercise of writing a letter. And I started the letter, and I don't recall now if the letter was to God or just sort of free-floating, but I started the letter, Daddy, where were you? And that was such a, I don't even know where that came from, but somehow I wanted my dad to be there. And I think earlier, Daniel, when I said I certainly wouldn't have shared this with my dad was just the man's man, World War II veteran, hunter, golfer, fisherman, mm-hmm. all that stuff. And I think he would have just, I don't know how he would have reacted, but what I realized in writing that letter, where were you?
Yeah,
I just wanted him to acknowledge, gosh, that must have hurt.
Ugh.
Or even better, well, I'll go up there to that school I'll whip that PE teacher's butt. And that would have been even better. But in the process, I forgave my dad. He really didn't know about it. I mean, he didn't know what happened.
Yeah.
But it does belie a deeper longing that I just wish he would have been more engaged in my life to know that I was hurting.
But I
spoke forgiveness to both of those men. As I said, they're both long dead. Probably they both died in the late 1960s.
Yeah.
Hmm.
which shows we can still learn to forgive those who have gone on.
Yes.
We don't have to be bound to that.
Well, yes.
Well, we are out of time. Guys, thanks so much. This was just a healing conversation for me to have, just to talk about these things. And we're going to sign off today and hope you will join us again for our next landmark. That's all for now.